Was der Technik zu sagen? Okay, well, 5 of us, I guess I can slowly start. So, we have our denotational semantics, not just for programs, but for assertion language as well. And we can now return to the business of horror rules from the last time. And we are going to do two things at the same time. So we will propose a system of axioms and rules with derivability that denoted as a single turnstile, syntactic turnstile, and check soundness. So for axioms, they of course should be valid under every interpretation in every state, and for rules, if the premise or premises of the rule happen to be semantically valid, then the conclusion should be valid as well. And we have already seen first candidate for this, namely we had very trivial denotation of skip, and we suggested that obvious axiom describing perfectly what skip is doing is saying that it is not changing any assertions. So if something was valid before execution of skip, it should remain valid after that. And just so that all this notation comes back, validity of Hoare triples or PCAs, partial correctness assertions, was defined as for any state and for every interpretation, if precondition holds in this state under this interpretation, then in what you obtain from this state by execution of this command. So remember, this denotation is a partial function. This thing can be either another state or bottom or divergence constant. And I think I introduced two possible conventions. What happens with validity of assertions when you have divergence constant? One was the one that we are using now, and we will keep using most of the time, saying that all possible assertions are verified by the divergence, by the bottom, by the non-termination thing. The other one I suggested, which is also possible, was the total convention, saying that nothing holds in that the divergence constant. So for the time, so if our partial function corresponding to command C does not is not defined on sigma, meaning really that the program does not terminate, then this holds trivially under this partial or PCA convention. So I think that we can agree that if we pattern match this definition of validity of our triple and this function, so that the notation of another way of writing it, if you recall, is that the notation of I switched the wrong light on. Skip is just interpreted by identity function on states, which is a total function, which is a special case of a partial function. So hopefully we can agree that if it is the case that A holds at sigma, then this thing, which is the identity function applied to sigma, still makes A true. Right? So then these are completely trivial definition. There is really no reasoning, no proof involved. It is just so that we start to pattern match the notation and the obvious thing that it's really saying. Now for the assignment. So we proposed, you remember I was experimenting with various forms of rules, and in the end we agreed that this kind of backward condition where you substitute A for X before assignment is executed, and only after execution of assignment you have B itself. Sounds like a plausible candidate for a rule. But we learn painfully that we should be careful, that things that seem nice and innocent can be puzzling. So the advantage of having semantics is that we can verify things on our finger and remember that I use semantic update function, which is just changing a given function and a partial function on one single argument, in this case x. You remember that I was also suggesting several other possible notations. For example, we could also write the thing on the right-hand side of this equality as sigma with x updated to a sigma. Remember that this was arithmetical expression of our language, it was in this thing is what? So what were the notation of arithmetical expressions? They were defined as what kind of semantic entities? What mathematical objects there were? There were some sets, relations, functions. Do you remember the slides of last lectures? And what if there were some kind of relations, functions, what were they, domains, what they range? So, okay, we can recall that there were functions. We were trying to interpret everything using functions, and just that for commands, because of non-termination business, we had to switch ultimately to partial functions. But for arithmetical expression, there was no such problems. So there were functions from what to what? What was the domain of this function? I mean, create a set of states, right? So here I'm already applying this function to a concrete argument. Maybe I should put those things on another slide. And it was going to integer to numbers, whereas Boolean expressions were also functions from states to, well, to whatever, objects of true values, true and false. And commands themselves, they were what? I already said they were partial functions from states to states. Right? You execute a command in a state and you obtain another state, whereas when you evaluate the numerical expression in a given state, you get a number. And whether when you evaluate a Boolean expression in a given state, maybe this is what confused you because I didn't write this superscript I for interpretation. So if one is super pedantic, one should probably say that there are functions of two arguments, the set of interpretations and the set of states. But quite often we'll just... No, sorry. We are now not talking about meta language, but other programming language. So, of course, interpretation do not play any role. Right. So, I already started to think about assertion language where you have additional kind of variables. So, no, these were just those things. There was no suppression happening here at all. So, this was one notation for update, and another notation for update was. X equal to C. Right. And as I said, the one that I'm using, I'm trying more or less consistency to use in this lecture, although not necessarily in other ones, is this. Okay, so what the assignment function was doing was to update the state. So now, in order to show soundness of this, or validity of this axiom, this is really an axiom, a rule with no premises, we need to show that whenever it is the case that a given assertion, so now this thing is, this B is already in the extended language, holds under given state sigma under given interpretation because B itself can already involve some logical variables with A replacing X. It should be the case that this updated state sigma makes B itself true. And well, it's actually equivalent way of saying the same thing. And this is another instance of a situation where mathematically nothing very surprising or thrilling is happening, but actually there is a bit of work that one needs to do pen and paper in order to prove things formally and spotlessly, say. And of course, a natural candidate for a proof technique here would be induction on the complexity of our Boolean, assertion B. If you remember, assertions were built out of equality and inequality statements using logical connectives, Boolean connectives, and possibly infinitary conjunction, which can be also used to simulate quantifiers. So we need to start with the atomic case, and again, this is where the fun is. So we need to show that equality between two arithmetical expressions, A1 and A2, where possible, where X, where the program variable or location X is replaced by another expression, arithmetical expression A, so we need to substitute this A for X both here and here. Is that this equality is true under a given interpretation of log var in a state sigma, if and only if the denotation of the arithmetical of this substituted arithmetical expression in a given state under a given interpretation. All right, so this A1 and A2, they aren't living already in the bigger language. They can be themselves arithmetical expression of our imp, but they can be also expressions involving this additional type of variables themselves. This is why we have this I. Whereas A itself occurs here, it's in this assignment command, so A is arithmetical expression from the programming language itself. Maybe it would be better to use slightly different notational convention, but I hope that it's clear after I said that. Sorry, so this is, I said that we need to prove this. This is actually the satisfaction definition for the equality statement itself. Equality between two arithmetical expressions holds or is equal to top, to true, if and only if they are actually equal. On the other, so this is about this bit, where B is this equality statement. And now what this thing amounts to if our B is our equality. Well, we have something looking quite unwieldy here if we unfold the definition of satisfaction for equality in the same way as we did in the preceding item. So what we are saying here is that this function in interpreting the extended arithmetical expressions, possibly involving log var, in a given state and under a given interpretation I, with the state sigma where X was already updated with the denotation of our A, arithmetical expression from the object language in sigma, is equal to this. Well, it's exercise in writing longer and longer formulas, unfolding definition. And in order to show this equivalence, again, probably one needs to do it by induction, this time on complexity, of arithmetical expressions. We need a lemma which says that this slightly tautological looking thing involving this equality, where this A prime can be either A1 or A2, the extended arithmetical expression, is the same thing as the interpretation of, now in the original state sigma, with no funny games playing and being played on what this function does on variables. But we're interpreting now, we are looking now at the notation not of the original arithmetical expression A1 or A2, but at the expression with arithmetical expression of the object language substituted for X. So in a sense, we are pushing here semantic update into, well, interpretation of syntactic substitution. Is this clear? And this thing here is precisely what we had in the unfolding of what we had on the left-hand side. I don't think they would be thrilled by me continuing in this way. And I trust that everybody who survived until now in the lecture would be, is able to do this kind of induction. This is also the kind of things that you are doing in, let's say, GLOIN, where defining satisfaction definition, where stating satisfaction definition and giving semantics for, let's say, first order logic. It's as soon as you see that this is the conceptual structure of the proof, the rest is just, you know, writing this thing down. Right. So this is what is happening with the assignment. And now we can also recall our earlier failed attempts as the assignment rule. We now know what would be a way of showing that these are not valid axioms or rules. You need to find a state sigma, interpretation I, and, well, concrete instances of this A. I already suggested 2 weeks ago how they look like, where you can disprove, counting on your fingers on a piece of paper, that these are indeed not valid instances of, this wouldn't be indeed valid axioms for assignment. And actually, now I want to apologize and correct myself, because then I said, oh, but you know, we can write yet another rule which would be a better one. No, it wasn't. I wasn't fixing anything. I was repeating the same mistake. And I realized it only after I wrote those slides. So remember, this is what I wrote. This axiom is no better than those two. And now that I said that, it's probably easy to guess that very similar example, counterexamples than the ones that we used to convince ourselves that those are not really axioms for assignment would also kill off this one. So one can indeed state a proper forward assignment rule. This is how it should look like. So I was a bit too cavalier with what was going on in the post condition, the substitution, so it should not be Z that is semantically substituted by but X. And yet another good rule for, or good axiom for the assignment would not use this infinitary disjunction, which, if you look at it, is pretty much simulating existential quantifier, if you remember how I define existential quantifier. You could also use some, because we have in this assertion language, we have meta variables or logical variables. You could also use those logical variables, sorry, in order to store the original value of X before assignment took place, and then after assignment happened, reuse this I to refer to what used to be next before assignment. So we have three different variants of possible axioms for assignment, one using syntactic substitution, another using infinitary operators, and now yet another using this log var to store the value of X. How should we compare those things? It should not be the case that we have to write three different axioms, and clearly it should be possible that one can imagine that one can still play more tricks. There should be some way of relating those possible axioms for assignment, and in a sense, one of them, or maybe whichever one of them you choose, should be most general. We should have some way of deriving judgments from, of deriving valid partial collector as PCAs from other PCAs that have been already shown valid. So this is an example of such a rule for a concrete command, namely for sequencing. This is already something that we have seen before. And we have already agreed that sequencing is interpreted using composition of partial functions, defined in an obvious way. And we can show now that this rule preserves validity or is sound, namely, if it is the case that A, the thing, the first of the premises is valid, so if we have that this holds semantically, and so is the second of the premises, and we are now in a state which makes precondition of the whole thing true, we won't, of course, end up now after execution of the composition of two, these two commands in something which verifies three. So if you look at the first of the premises and our assumption doing a state satisfying A1, given the definition of validity of PCAs that we have, we get that the state obtained from our sigma by execution denotation of the command C1 satisfies A2, right? And we also have that this thing is valid, that in any state in which A true is held, if we execute now C2, we obtain, oh God, you see what happened. It should be, of course, A3. I think I was permuting A2 and A3 here, and of course, if you're a bit careless, then you are left with. So this is A3. And this is precisely the definition of composition of partial functions. So proof of soundness is super trivial here. Conditionals. Well, for conditionals, I didn't even give you an example or a candidate of what could be a trivial or a valid rule. Actually, is there anybody here who has not seen those rules? So some people have attended SEMPROC, and at any rate, they have been already done in the tutorials or not? Or not? Not really. Ah, okay, then I can continue. So how should a rule for conditional look like? This is a trivial proposal, right? So I'm saying that so I have then branch and else branch. If the execution of what you have in the then branch in a state satisfying A1 produces something where A2 is true, but at the same time, also execution of what we have in the else branch in a state which is satisfying A1 produces a state where A2 is true. So it doesn't matter whether we take then branch or else branch. Then, of course, the entire annotation, the precondition are good enough also to annotate the whole conditional. Is it clear that this is valid in a trivial way? What do you think? Can I do any better than this? Actually, the whole content of the lecture this week and the next lecture that I'm going to give, whenever it's going to happen, is precisely about making it precise in what sense some rules cannot be improved upon. Yes?
That's not the most general condition we can get, because, for example, B is always true, then C, 2, doesn't be true.
Right, so we are not using in any way the guard of the conditional, and this seems dodgy. This seems very much suboptimal, and given that, as you have seen in the tutorials, our ultimate goal is to annotate programs, it is very possible that we may not be able to write some annotations that that we want to write if we postulate such lousy, boring rule. So what we propose instead is, if you are a bit more careful, then you realize, of course, that as far as what is in the then branch is concerned, we know that this thing is fired only if the guard is true. So I'm actually narrowing things down here, right? Instead of insisting that this thing holds, which presumably is harder to satisfy, I'm saying, okay, you don't have to look at all possible states that where A1 is true. You only need at those states where not only A1, but also the guard of the conditional holds. And if in those states, you always obtain A2 after executing C1. And at the same time, so we are dividing all possible states where A1 holds into those where conditional is true and conditional is false. If also when you start when conditional is false and then execute what is in the else branch and you also obtain something where A2 holds, then of course this is a valid. This looks like a sensible rule to postulate. Notice, by the way, that again, here we are using something written in a more restricted language of object language of Boolean expressions. And now we're promoting this to assertion because we always want the Boolean expression, the potential, the class of possible guards of conditionals and while loops to be a subset of the assertion language of, on the meta level. I leave proving soundness to you. We have already discussed, I have already said why this is true, so it's just a matter of writing down in this notation or in those symbols this very argument. And again, so I have, if I would replace this semantic turnstile with the syntactic single one and write it as an inference rule, I have then two possible rules for if then else. I clearly suggested that this one is better, more optimal, more powerful, more flexible. Then it should be somehow possible to derive this suboptimal or boring rule from the good one. We have to have some way of relating two possible rules for a given program construct. And similarly, we can find some optimal rules for a while. I mean, in a sense, did we really need conditionals, in fact? We have assignment, we have while loops. We can obviously simulate conditional. Is it clear how? Or maybe we should do it. Well, it's not so important for the lecture itself, but just to make clear that this is really syntactic sugar. So let's, of course, one always needs to have sufficient supply of free or unused program variables, locations, this would be assuming here. So this trick would not necessarily work if we were, if we want to consider programming languages with a finite fixed number of locations. So if I want to simulate if B then C1 else C2, I pick X which does not occur in C1, C2. So this is where I use the fact that I have enough additional variables, no matter how big, how many of them were already used in C1 or C2. So I need unrestricted. Supply of procvar then. And well, what can I do? So, and we are living in a world where we have integers, in particular we have 0 and 1. So now I want to use somehow this x to control the thing. So I'm setting this new variable to 1, while b do c1, sorry, while b and x equal to 1 do c1 and x equal to 0, right? In this way, I took care of the then branch. So if conditional was true that I knew that I entered that loop, so at this point of execution in the program, x is still equal to 1 only if the conditional, if the guard was false. And now just to avoid this rule firing up again, I set it to 0. And if I want to be super hygienic, of course, I can restore the value to 1, but this is a variable, presumably, that is not being used. So this is not compositional, because if you now have this thing as a part of larger program, it may happen this x is being used in this larger program. So I need to rename variables or whatever. But in a sense, of course, conditionals are redundant in our language. And now, having the notational semantics, we can make it more specific, so we could turn it into an exercise showing that the notation of what the function corresponding to conditional does on any given state with maybe some update to the value of x itself is the same as what this thing is doing in a given state. This is another advantage of having some mathematically precise kind of semantics, either the notational one as we have here, or some kind of small step or a big step, or maybe game semantics or what have you. Because then you can show in a strict sense that two programs are equivalent or equivalent up to value of one, up to value of almost all the registers. But anyway, this was a detour. So the fact that everything that can be done with conditionals in presence of assignments can be done in presence of while loops suggests that we will have similar situation here. So I can again pose a suboptimal version of our rule. So a very trivial take on the notion of invariant of the loop would be that I need to check that the body of the while loop preserves this invariant A, and then it is the case, surely, that the entire loop, no matter how many times it's iterated, still preserves A. Why this is okay even if this loop does not terminate? Because of our convention regarding non-termination constant, right? So if this program is non-terminating, then I can write any postcondition whatsoever. But of course, again, it seems too restrictive not to mention B. So the right take on invariance is that as far as the body of the loop is concerned, we know that it will be only fired, like here, if the in those situations where the guard of the loop is true prior to execution. So we need to know that the body of the loop executed in a state where not only this assertion A, candidate for invariant, is true, but also the guard of the loop holds. And then after the execution, A should be still true. We don't know about B anymore. If we know this much, then we can infer that whenever the entire loop is executed in a state satisfying A, then A is true after the execution, but something more is true as well. So this loop, here we are in a situation where this loop has terminated. If it terminated, that means that we managed somehow to falsify the conditional. Again, if it did not terminate, we could write false here as well. So it doesn't really matter. So this is how the rule for while looks like. Yeah, I was already using the word invariant, which I presume you have seen anyway in quite a few courses, including the basic one of algorithms, and you had to use anyway for sure in tutorials. Exercise, proof soundness. Well, actually, no. This would not be fair just to tell you now, play around with this. We introduced this functionals, and now is our first opportunity to make sure that we understand what this definition is doing. So let's prove soundness, try to prove soundness of this rule with respect to ordinary rational semantics. So what we need to show is, again, that whenever the premise is a valid PCA, then conclusion is valid PCA as well. So what we're really saying, in other words, is that if we reformulate the premise of the rule, it is saying that whenever in a given state conjunction of the invariant and the guard of the loop is true under a given interpretation, then the partial function, the notation of the body of the loop executed in that state, makes it true. This is the assumption. And now we want to say something about the partial function interpreting the while loop, which we know is defined using this functional. And as you remember, it was obtained via this Clini fixed point theorem. So iterating arbitrarily many times the functional, starting from the empty partial function, so partial functions which is undefined for any state whatsoever. How does one show it? Well, because this thing is pointwise, all that we need to show is that the order is slightly confusing here. What I should say is that for any natural number, for any number of potential iterations of the body of the loop, and any state that you choose, it's important again when you prove things by induction to choose the right quantifiers so that then you can fire then the induction hypothesis at the critical moment. So we want to quantify over those states and interpretations as well. Well, this is the important bit, the state. We want to show that whenever it is the case for whichever state you choose, that the state that you give me, sigma, that A holds, then no matter how many the state that is universally quantified over, then no matter how many times I iterate the body of the loop in such a way that the loop terminates, and after the termination, A and not B will be true. Inductions Anfang, the base case, is so if this n is equal to zero, then we just forget about it. Right? We have empty function, which is undefined on any state. And this means that this thing here is equal to non-termination constant. And by our convention, of course, any assertion is made true by non-termination constant. Notice that all the time we are using this convention here. So if I wanted to have rules or calculus for total correctness assertion, which are saying something, which are giving us a much better guarantee that you can actually execute this command, possibly involving loops, and you will actually terminate and moreover obtain something over A holds, we would need to design our system slightly different. But we will not get to total correctness assertions today. And, I didn't put the rest on the slides, so then I need to do the rest on the blackboard then. I think I'm missing something, namely the implement to erase this blackboard. What have I done this week? The small one, yes.
In the corner there.
Okay. Absolutely improper place for it. My bad. So we agreed that we are already done with base case. We can now do the induction step. And remember that induction hypothesis is universally quantified over this sigma and I. So now, assume that I have then that A holds in our state where we begin the execution. Maybe let me, just in case, use my notes. Thank you. So now we have this thing here with n plus 1. Which means we are applying our functional PBC to this. All right, so with the one has to be careful with how you associate the brackets here. The functional takes two arguments. One of them is a function itself, and another one is the state. So the state sigma here should be what you obtain by n application of our functional starting from the empty function and sigma. And wait, what is the function here? Right. Where this thing is a function that is producing sigma if the guard of the loop did not hold in sigma, and otherwise no, wait, I think that I messed my notes here. Ah, right, so Fn is just n times application of the functional starting from divergent constants of the empty function. No, it's empty function, of course. So this is what this is. All right, but then there is some redundancy here, because then it should not be the state that you obtain already by n applications of the functional. What was I doing here? No, then this should be just sigma, sorry. It's this is unfolding the definition. It's cretinous. Right, and now we, by definition of our of our functional Phoebe C. We know that this is either sigma itself, if B holds in sigma, I can write. If B does not hold in sigma, I can write. Or Fn applied to sigma. Yes. Sorry. Right, and then we know our induction hypothesis was saying that if we apply Fn starting from something where A holds, we will obtain something where the assertion, the invariant itself is still true, but the guard of the loop becomes false. Now, do we have that A right. And now we can, here, for this part, we can use star. So we know that here the guard of the loop was true, and we know that A was true here. Jesus Christ, it was so trivial. Sorry for this. This is precisely what happens when you are clumsy about notation. You end up confusing yourself and everybody else. So that was my bad, but maybe it would be also a warning for everybody else not to do stupid things that I just done. Right. So by our assumption, we have that invariant of the loop holds in the original state sigma. And here we are already in the case where the guard of the loop is true. So by star, we get that here we get something where A is true. And then the induction hypothesis is saying that if you start in something with A is true and do this thing corresponding to n unfolding or n iteration of the loop, you obtain something where A is still, the invariant is still true, but the post condition, but the guard is false. Is this clear? And I don't blame you, Dave. I managed to confuse you. I did absolutely my best to do. But I hope that actually the triviality of the reasoning is that is star clear. I wasted that. Good 10 minutes because of that. Right. So, well, apart from the problems that we had now, which was just a result of me being clumsy, we had already several possible rules for assignments, conditionals, and loops as well, the trivial one where, which was not using in any way guard, I mean, this would be a trivial version of the rule for loops, which is not using guard at all. And we want to somehow make inferences between BCAs involving the same command, and then building more complex commands out of simple one, but possibly different pre and post conditions. So this time we are not being inductive in C. So let's think what happens if you have, if you know that something calls for a logically weaker precondition. And moreover, somebody gives us information that the state that we are in satisfies, in fact, stronger condition than the precondition of rule that we know that is valid. Then, because this is true, and because this is true, we know that A, not just A in prime, has to hold in sigma. And because we know that this rule is valid, we obtain B after execution of C here. So we can always strengthen the precondition. The logical way of using the word stronger is that the more consequences you can derive, like here, the stronger formula is, I should have said here. So is the question, if this is what stronger means, is it interesting what is the strongest possible precondition? What is it? Can you give me a simple algorithm for computing strongest preconditions? Very, very simple algorithm indeed. What, I mean, it's very obvious candidate. What is the... So what is there a single strongest formula? If this is definition of what stronger means, what is the strongest formula of all? It's false, right? We have that ex falso quod libet, so if I put false or bottom in place of a prime, this is always good. And indeed, a triple false C, B, is always valid, whatever the C and B are. So finding strongest precondition is fool's game. But in order to find best possible axiomatic specification for a command, we need to find the weakest preconditions, relatively to not only given command C, but also postcondition B. And dually, of course, we can always weaken the precondition. And in order to find the best possible axiomatic specification or kind of semantics, we would need to find strongest precondition relatively to it, strongest postcondition, this should be post, not pre, relatively to each precondition. But it's pointless to do two things at the same time. So normally one is looking at the problem of weakest preconditions and looking for strongest postconditions is just dual. So the fact that we can play this kind of logical games with precondition and postconditions can be compactified into a single rule, which we'll call consequence rule. And notice that there is something funny here. So far we had this saying that this triple can be derived using all the rules we have seen so far. But here I'm writing some, not syntactic, but semantic turnstile. Well, this of course makes proof of soundness trivial, because we have already semantic turnstile involved, and in fact, this is what we did already on the preceding slide. But then I need to explain why I'm writing, well, maybe not pseudo-rule, but pseudo-proof system, which involves checking some semantic assertions. Can we do any better? Can I write some kind of system where this double semantic turnstile in the site premises is replaced by some kind of syntactic derivability? What do you think? Does this sound like a plausible plan, or something could possibly go wrong? I don't know how much those of you who attended Gloin or Tchprok have heard about some general limitative results. Wait, you all of you have attended BFS. So were there some kind of really dangerous general results at BFS that I may be alluding to? So maybe not even just for assertions, but can we hope for a complete set of decidable, finitary, finite or in sense of finite scheme of rules for PCAs? Such that a triple is valid if and only if you can derive it from this given nice decidable set of axioms and rules, possibly finite, of course. If you're finite, then you're even better than this iTable. Well, that would involve, imply, of course, that valid PCAs are recursively enumerable. So if we had decidable notion of axiom and decidable inference rules, you could easily check if a given sequence of PCAs is a valid derivation in this syntactic Terstein thing. And then in order to recursively enumerate all valid PCAs, you could just combine this to Turing machines, one is, which is writing all possible finite sequences of those PCAs. There is something unpleasant in that I allowed this doesn't look good. Does anybody have plug for a MacBook? Why is it running out of battery so soon? This is something that I genuinely did not expect. Okay, so maybe I will call Christopher in the meantime. I can explain what I had in mind on Blackboard. Well, first of all, what I'm alluding to is that we have a generic statement for non-termination. Right? The triple of this form is valid if and only if C does not stop at all in whatever state it is executed. So assuming that I have some way of recursively enumerating valid assertions would mean that I have a way of recursively enumerating those programs which never stop. Does this sound plausible? This is precisely what would make halting problem decidable. So this is the missing half of decidability of halting problem. Is it clear why this bullet point holds? In general, so this is a general principle. This is not specific just to PCAs and a concrete proof system. This the same argument, for example, shows that the set of derivable or valid formulas of first order logic is recursively enumerable because we have axiom system, a set of axioms and rules for PCAs, for first order logic formulas, and using the same argument, saying write all possible sequences of first order formulas and then run another Turing machine, so following the first one, which keeps writing and writing longer and longer sequences, the other one is going through the same tape and leaving out only the deductions that are sequences that are valid deductions. And the last step in such deduction is a derivable formula. And if you allow this thing to go on infinitely long, then in the end you will obtain something which is which is an enumeration of all valid formulas. It doesn't matter in what syntax we are talking about. And on the other hand, there was, of course, something slightly dodgy here because I'm having now an assertion language which involves infinitary conjunctions. So we are talking about possibly infinitely large formulas, but in other words, I could just restrict the attention of my restrict my attention to this fragment of the assertion language where I only have quantifiers, let's say, which, as I said, they can be simulated in an infinitary language, but We can just restrict the attention of to the finite fragment with quantifiers only, and then we would be dealing exactly with, as far as the assertion language is concerned, some kind of quantified language of arithmetics. And again, I don't know how much was mentioned in BFS, let's say, or in Gloin about Gödel's incompleteness theorem, but for a very similar reason, we cannot have recursive enumeration of all valid arithmetical formulas. This is what Gödel has shown. So, in a sense, our problem is hopeless. But if we are fine with the rules, like this consequence rule, which involves some syntactic kind of judgment, we can talk about relative completeness. So, in order to check valid applications of the consequence rule, because this is the only one which is looking in a slightly funny way, we would need an oracle for all valid arithmetical statements. So we assume that we have some. So you may ask, of course, what is the point of such a completeness result when I don't tell you how to decide the assertion language part? Well, first of all, sensibly large fragments of arithmetics are decidable. Some examples involve systems like Skolem's primitive recursive arithmetics or a chosen fragment of Presburger arithmetic. Presburger arithmetic is one where you don't allow yourself unrestricted multiplication, you only allow multiplication by constant. So, glorified addition. And many sensible subsystems of arithmetic like this PRA were considered by proof theories, of course, because of general reasons like the Gödel's incompleteness theorem, they cannot be as powerful as the entire arithmetic. But for almost all meaningful, well, maybe not almost all, but for many meaningful applications, they are good enough. At least if you want to have some kind of heuristics in your tool. And this is, in fact, what is happening, I guess, already quite a lot with Framasi. You don't always have a guarantee that something that is quite obviously true will be actually shown to be true by the tool that you are working with. But sometimes rephrasing the assertion just a little or adding some intermediate assertions makes things magically fall within some decent, within the scope of some decent subsystem that that your tool, whether it's Framasi, whether it's very fast, whether it's Daphne, or whichever part of arithmetics your SMT solver is using in its modular theories part. And then things may improve. And if you want to do things in a more systematic and streamlined way, but you're happy with helping the computer on your own, then you use proof assistance, something that, as I said, we are doing in SEMPROC rather than here, where humans can guide machines a little bit. So these are the rules that we have. Rather trivial and nice ones for all the basic commands and the one that we struggled with for a while loop, but these are all purely syntactic ones, so it's obvious how proof trees would look like. And then the one where you have some announcement from infinitely wise mathematician, which is telling you this assertion is true, this assertion is true, and therefore, if you have derived this, then this can be considered derived as well. So, of course, we are not going to progress much with this relative completeness business, but maybe I should not make any moves here, but but let's have a look again at the original program that I gave you. Actually, I realized that the annotations were a bit too restrictive. So you remember that was our factorial code with y using as accumulator and x being both the input and the counter of the loop, which is, right, this was the program that we had. We wanted to show that whatever is the original value of x, so here again we are using those auxiliary variables to store value of I. Then after the execution, it will be the case that y will be the factorial of what was originally in x. And as I said, instead of saying that I has to be strictly greater than zero, we can say that it's greater or equal to. That was a bit more than I was. It's a situation is even a bit better than what I was originally claiming. How, and well, here I'm using actually the convenience of having this infinite disjunctions in order to define my factorial. So how can I play this game? Well, first of all, I can extend my original assertion with something very, very trivial, saying that 1 is equal to 1. But this is, in fact, the expression which is arising from substituting substituting 1 for y here. And y is not appearing anywhere else. So after I did the assignment, this is what I have here. This is an obvious application of the assignment rule. Okay. Maybe we need to tweak it a little bit in order to have something where I could possibly use the rule for while loops that we had. So trivial transformation. Well, trivial. Sorry. It's trivial mathematically, but the only one which is not purely automated here. Right? So a bit of creativity that I'm allowing myself here is, well, if y is equal to 1, then multiplying by y is not doing much. Because x was equal to y, then factorial of x is equal to the factorial of y. Right? It's obvious that this is a valid consequence, but as you probably already learned painfully, finding good candidates for invariants is always where the fun is. So this, I'm claiming that this is my candidate for invariant. And now let's see if I'm able to pull it off with the set of rules that I had. So, well, first of all, in order to apply the, so if this is my candidate for A, then here I write A and not B. Sorry, A and B, where B itself is something formulating using negation. Right? So this is my B in the rule for while, and this is my A. And now I can replace x factorial by x times x minus 1. So we know that x is strictly greater than 0 because we have those two things. This is why it's fine to write x minus 1. And here, well, I'm using a little bit the fact that I have this infinite disjunction defining my factorial, right? So of course the point is now that I have here something, some sub-expression of this form y times x, and because our rule for assignment was backward looking, now I would be able to replace this y times x with y. So that's where I am. Okay, now it would be ideal if I had both occurrence, instead of this x, also something over x minus 1. But x is strictly greater than 0, even only if x minus 1 is weakly greater than 0. So now I have an expression where I have just two occurrences of this x minus 1. And then after the assignment, I can replace it with exit self. And this is looking, so remember, that was exactly my candidate for A. So things are looking good. And now, after the execution of the entire loop, I have this A true, and not the guard, but the guard itself was negated, right? So I have not x equal to 0. Sorry, so I took a shortcut and I replaced not x is equal to 0 by simply x equal to 0. Anyway, what matters is, so I know that x is equal to 0, so its factorial is 1. So y times x factorial is y times 1, which is just y. So our proof system works for some reasonable purposes. So what happened here is that I use rules for assignment, I use rules for sequencing, I use while loops, and I use consequence. And as you see, none of the uses of the consequence rule, well, maybe with the exception of this one, was particularly badly looking. You can imagine that whenever you have some reasonable bit of arithmetic built into your tool, your tool would be able to verify that this is a properly annotated program. And this is what I'm saying here on this slide. So we have a sound system which can be used for annotating programs, and now we can return to question of relative completeness. Are our rules as general as possible, assuming somebody gives us an oracle for arithmetics? And this is where I will continue, presumably, or maybe even after Christmas. So if we don't see each other, have Merry Christmas and Guten Rutsch in CR.